This is class 21, right?
Yep.
Yay. March 10? March 11th, 2008. And today we're discussing awakening mind. Which is a kind of a big topic. So I left you with some homework from our last class, which was about sitting with a set of 22 similes for awakening mind. How was this for you? Randy.
Got through 3.5.
That's good. What was your experience?
The first three felt familiar in my body. The fourth one started to not touch, not reach anything that I could recognize. And after that, I just got totally lost.
After that, it was just words.
Yeah. I mean, there was nothing there. I couldn't find any meaning in my body there.
So earth, gold, and moon you could relate to. And then I see that Gampopa says, these three varieties are on the novice's level. We need to discuss what novice means here. Okay. One of the points of discussion, I'd like to say consternation, is, in the Tibetan tradition at least, is between the description of the five paths, which are referenced here in this section. I would say the traditional descriptions that you find in the sutras and in the commentaries versus what people actually experience. And this shows up particularly in some of the Mahamudra commentaries where the stages as described in Mahamudra correspond to the stages described in the five paths, except for one small difference. As we'll see later on, when you attain the first level of bodhisattvahood, you can enter 100 absorptions at will, and you can see 100 Buddhas and go to 100 Pure Lands in the second level, and then it's 1,000 and so forth. It just gets... And people didn't experience going to 100 Pure Lands. And so while these things correspond, why aren't these attainments, abilities arising like this? Well, one way to look at this is it's a difference between a mythic description and a literal description. So when they say novice, one should see this, it's good to keep in mind perhaps that they're talking mythically here, so that the abilities and described are greatly enhanced and elaborated, and you just feel like you're nobody. Now, why is it expressed in such elaborate language? That is an expression of people's admiration and value that they placed on it, and it's highly poetic. So, but it's probably helpful just to give a very brief overview of the five paths. I'll just do it, if I can, in five sentences. The first path, which is called the path of preparation or the path of accumulation, or whatever you want to call various translations, is about building the basic abilities, and in particular building a capacity and attention. The second path, which is called by various names as well, the path of union, the path of accommodation, is as you begin to see things. And there's a lot of adjustment that needs to take place in the system as you begin to see what's possible. The path of seeing is where you have your first experience of first stable experience or understanding of non-duality, of non-self, and all of these things. It's that initial seeing, and it's a big deal is made out of it. And then there comes the path of training, whereas you now you know what the game is about. Now you've got to work to actually bring it fully into all aspects of your experience. And that goes through the 10 bodhisattva levels up until the path of no training, which is Buddhahood. Okay? Now when you read this, you think, oh. And when they say that the establishment of stable awakening mind is equivalent to the first path, you go, oh my God, how does anybody do this? But then we get into the whole, but if you read this as mythic descriptions, then you say, okay, this is a high ideal to aspire to. But what actually happens is somewhat different. That help? Yeah. Anybody else spend some time with this? No answer came, the stern reply. Kara. It's not going to do any good looking at it now.
I got water in my mouth. I don't know that I really why did you call me? I don't know that I really absorbed it so much as I kind of kept getting number 15, possessing special clairvoyance accompanied by great wisdom is like a great king who can benefit other sentient beings without any restriction. The special clairvoyance
mm-hmm.
accompanied by great wisdom is what I found myself kind of tuning into when I was
What's the metaphor there? It's it's the one of a king.
Yes, yeah. Number 15.
So you like that one?
I did.
You like to be able to know everything?
No.
No.
No. I mean, the clairvoyance. What I was really thinking that meant was more like a intuition, like
a profound intuition.
Profound intuition.
Okay.
Like
that's what I meant by knowing everything, but. I understand.
Well, but just because you can intuit things doesn't mean that you know everything.
Yeah, we're saying the same thing in different words.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes, that would be nice, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Okay. Chuck.
Well, I started looking at the one about the ocean.
Yes.
And first of all, if you just think of the ocean itself, it is disturbed by all sorts of things that are going on. If you think of the underneath the surface, the ocean depths, it is very quiet down there and isn't disturbed by all the things that are happening on top. So I think they ought to change it to the ocean depths instead of just the ocean.
Well,
or maybe they left out some words, I don't know.
But that's something you could relate to. You could imagine having a depth of attention or a depth of presence. So the other stuff like the waves are going on, but
right,
deep down,
underneath it all, it doesn't matter.
All of that stuff just comes and goes.
Right.
Yeah, that's probably what they meant here. So I don't think they meant that the ocean was this calm, all right. But it things come and go in the ocean, but it does not change. Okay.
Right.
Anybody else? Steve, you were skiing. You didn't have time for this. Joe, how about you?
I tried to approach these, you know, four at a time, but after the first three, like Randy said, and maybe even with those, I had a reaction of confusion because it seemed so massive. I got into this thing about taxonomy. This is that, and that's that, and this is that. And then the constructions of the similes were so, or metaphors were so, I was okay if I said bodhicitta is like this, but it was all confused with the perfection of this and the perfection of that and the accompanying element of that. So finally I went to the, I had to re-remember that these descriptions are, they're descriptive instead of prescriptive. And
that's a very important point, yes.
I get lost in thinking that I should do this and to achieve that. So as a result of remembering that, I tried to recognize where these things were true in my own experience. And that seemed to offer some sort of door into.
This is very good, Joe, because Joe's describing how you approach these texts. We'll be getting into a lot of when we go through the vow of awakening mind. We get into the four black dharmas and the four white dharmas and all kinds of do's and don'ts. And when one reads these things, particularly coming from the background that we do, it's very easy to interpret these as a list of shoulds and what we're meant to be like. But Joe's point that these are not prescriptive, they're not telling you what you should be doing. They're descriptive. They're telling you what it's like. And in general, Buddhist morality is descriptive rather than prescriptive. So when we read accounts of people, you know, these lists of do's and don'ts, one way to read these is this is how a person who is awake behaves. And it is actually quite problematic to try to behave that way when you don't have either, well, any of, or lacking some of, the willingness, the know-how, or the capacity. If we try to do something, and this goes back to what you were referring to last time, Joe, when you said you aspire. That's a very healthy attitude, because if we don't have the capacity, then we aspire to have the capacity. We don't try to do the thing itself because we don't have the capacity. So there is a kind of assumption or an understanding of, you know where you are and you work with where you are all through this. Also, when you read this, you get the idea that it's a nice, smooth progression and you go through all of this and it just becomes, you know, you become wiser and deeper and more compassionate. It really doesn't work that way. Because, as we all know, the personality, everybody's personality, has many, many different bumps and wrinkles to it. And there are areas of our life where these intentions, these sentiments, these attitudes, they operate, and they operate very powerfully. And then there are other areas of our life or other situations when we become a five-year-old or a reactive this or what have you. And this is why we have all of that training to do, because it is through that training that we come to see where we aren't awake. And then we bring attention to that and we work on that so that we can be awake there as well. And so there's a constant work here. The idea that there's one experience of awakening and that takes care of everything, that's a lovely myth, but it's a myth. And one of the things I've come to observe in having the very good fortune in another stage of my life to meet some extraordinarily deeply trained people, like Kala Rinpoche and the previous Karmapa and so forth, is all of these people have their idiosyncrasies. Rinpoche hated answering letters. And, you know, his translator would come in with a stack of letters from people all over the world, and Rinpoche would say, "Can we just burn them?" And his translator would say, "No," and they'd just go through, and he'd write answers to all of them, and so forth. Karmapa was quite diabetic, and he loved food, particularly sweet food. Not exactly the best food for diabetics. So they all have idiosyncrasies, and we need to read this with an understanding that these, as I've been saying all through this, these are poetic descriptions. So seeing where you can connect with them, where you've had experiences which, oh yes, I connect with that, this is a good way to read it, because this way you're finding those qualities within yourself, and now we train in order to be able to expand the areas of our life in which those qualities can manifest. Okay. So let's turn to, unless there's anything anybody else would like to. Yes, Randy.
I think it's the sixth one. And the question is about, you know, is this intended to be a sequence? Because as I kind of went through them, there was sort of nothing there. And then I reached the one which was on ethics and manners, which made no sense to me until I read the footnote, which said the inspection of what constitutes our physical existence, our emotional and intellectual life, and that which we call the whole reality. And that sounds a whole lot like the separation of thoughts, feelings, and body sensations from mm-hmm. experience, which is something I both practice and teach on a regular basis. I mean, calling it ethics and manners didn't resonate in any way, but the footnote did.
What's the footnote number?
Number 4 in Gunther. Physical, yeah. Emotional, and intellectual life, and that which we call the whole of reality.
I'm not sure where you were in the footnotes.
Page 138.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, of 15, and then it says 4, 2 lines below that. Sorry.
Oh, the 4 Samir Prahana? No, the 4...
I can't pronounce that.
Ah, okay. All right. You're bringing up a very complicated topic here. Okay, let's go back to, you had trouble with the jewel mine, as that's, I think, number 6, right? Okay, in which the, when by the perfection of ethics, it is like a jewel mine forming a solid basis for precious virtues. Now, what this is referring to, when your relationship with awakening mind is sufficiently strong that you observe the ethics associated with awakening mind. It's not just an idea, it becomes how you live. Then it's described as being like a jewel mine, because from awakening mind you can only do good. Awakening mind will never lead you to do something harmful or evil. And so it's like a jewel mine, you're just going to get good things out of it. That's what it's saying. Okay. Now, the footnote that you refer to on page 138, footnote 15, you see these are the 37 topics. Usually these are referred to as the 37 factors of awakening. And the four this is, the five that's, and also all of this. When we come to the, later on, we'll come to the five paths, we'll go into this in more detail. But this is material which is common to all traditions of Buddhism, the Theravadan, the Mahayana. There are slightly different interpretations of this in the Mahayana and the Theravada, but they're basically the same. And again, going back to Joe's point, there is, when you read this or encounter this for the first time, you think, oh, well, first I got to get this, and then I got to get this, and then I got to get that. But in practice, it doesn't work like that. One builds an ability, but at various stages, certain ones come out. And they're really very straightforward things, even though people make a big deal out of them. The first four are the four foundations of mindfulness, which is mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of emotional states, and mindfulness of experience. Now, when you are fully mindful of all aspects of your experience, you're not doing too badly. So it's not that you master that and then move on to the next one. The next one is the four right efforts. And this is just really fundamental common sense. You know, I like to say profound common sense. The first right effort is to reduce the number of things that you're doing which make things worse. The second one is to stop doing those things which make things worse. The third one is to start doing things which make things better. And the fourth one is to strengthen those things which make things better. Well, this isn't rocket science. But even so, if you actually live, you know, think, okay, this situation isn't working for me. What am I doing to make things worse? What can I do about that? How can I stop them? You start thinking in these terms, then you're able to, you increase the agency you have in your life, internally and externally. And this is what it really means to be awake, is that you are able to pay attention, see things as they are, and address and work with them as appropriate. So again, you look at these as tools, not as qualities. Now I'm always doing the right thing. No, there are ways of approaching life. Does this help? Okay, good. Okay. The classification, again, we have accompanied by interest, strong intention, maturation, and removal of the two veils, or two distortions. And these are made to correspond with the range of experience from the very beginning stages of spiritual practice right up to full awakening. Without worrying too much about all of those stages, let's just take a look at the four steps that they're describing here. interest, strong intention, maturation, and removal of the two veils, well, we can say some kind of awakening. And think of any area of your life where you start, you're interested in something. I mean, it could be learning a skill. You start off with an interest in it. You know, you enrolled in cooking school. Okay, you start off with an interest in it. And I think actually that's a good example to use here. And out of that interest, or as that interest gathers momentum, then it becomes a strong intention. And so you start doing things out of that interest. You start taking classes. You start cooking on your own and experimenting with different things and so forth. And through this process, your ability to cook matures. You learn lots of things. And then at some point or other, you become a master cook. You really know how it is. Or maybe it's just a particular area of cooking. But this is the case whether it's computer programming, massage therapy, being a doctor, everything. Everything, we go through those four stages. We begin with an interest. It becomes an intention. Then we go through a process which is usually accompanied by a lot of training and assimilation. We understand what's involved and we're developing the abilities. And there's usually a lot of effort in that. And finally, it becomes just part of the way that we relate to the world, becomes part of our repertoire. That's what's being talked about here with respect to this quality of awakening mind. We hear about it and we go, oh, that's interesting. Yeah. And it resonates with our own spiritual questions, our own spiritual intention. And then we learn more about it, and then we begin to become not just interested, we think, I want to live this way. That's where it becomes an intention. And as we engage that intention, then we see, oh, that means I have to learn this. This means I have to have that capability. I need to be able to do this. And so now it really becomes, we really work at it. And eventually, it just becomes part of the way that we relate to the world. That's what's being talked about here. Okay? Now, the next section is why I brought our little chart, my flip chart here, because there is, yes. Sorry, Joe, please.
I just wanted to ask.
What page are there?
Gyaltsen Rinpoche has on page 149, has for the second one, which I think he translates as intention. He says the cultivation of bodhicitta with altruistic thought. A valid translation that... I guess my question is, in that second stage, is there a movement towards, I can accomplish something, there's a facet to what I'm interested in, which extends beyond myself.
I didn't check the Tibetan on this, so I'd have to go back. But I'm going to make a guess that as to the word which is strong intention, and I think it may be the word for seeking, where you're at your which involves an active pursuit. Now, don't forget the bodhicitta or awakening mind is the intention to wake up in order to help others. So it has a built-in altruistic quality to it. So Kunshō Gyaltsen's translation may be a little bit of a gloss. Okay. Now, this next bit... the classification by primary characteristics. this is really quite important, and also is the basis for a lot of confusion for people. The first division is basically reflects compassion and emptiness. Now, the usual translation here is relative awakening mind and ultimate awakening mind. And this appeals to the a distinction that's made all through Mahayana teaching. And again, you will see the translations as relatively real or relatively true, and ultimately real or ultimately true. The choice of relative has been extremely unfortunate. I no longer use this. And I also don't use the word true, or truths, rather. I do use the word truth. I don't use the word real anymore. First, let's talk about this notion of truth. One of the ways that we slip into difficulties, often without noticing it, is that we take an adjective such as true, and we form an abstract quality from it, which is a noun, such as truth. And we actually think we're talking about something that exists. Kant, to my knowledge, was the first one to cotton on to the problems here. Something happens. You say we see a car accident, or there's some kind of interaction that takes place at a party, which everybody talks about the next day. And one person says, this is what happened, and another person says, this is what happened, etc., etc. It's the old Rashomon problem. And what we'll say is, who was telling the truth? Okay? That's who's telling the truth. And the problem that arises here is that we very easily think that there is some quality called truth, which people are either have or don't have. But how do you tell whether somebody is telling the truth or not about what happened at the party? There's only one way. Yeah, Kara, you're going to say give them a lie detector test? No. What are you going to...
I'm going to be a smart aleck and go with the all-knowing intuition.
That's right. That's smart alecky. Thank you. That's why I call on you.
Just here to keep everybody awake.
Okay. How do you tell whether somebody is telling the truth?
Yes. I would say that part of why I say the intuition thing is that when you're able to take your own ego out of the equation and you can truly see people for their perspectives and appreciate their perspectives, then I think you're better at assessing who's telling the truth.
Yes, but that's still going to be a conclusion. We're not interested, or a hypothesis. It's based on my impressions like that. How do you actually tell whether they're telling the truth? Linnea?
You don't.
Oh, yes, you do.
You do?
Yeah. Oh, I left out one little thing. There's a security camera which records everything. How do you tell whether somebody's telling the truth? You compare what they say to what actually happened, if you happen to have a record of what happened. It's the only way to see whether they're telling the truth. What does this mean? It means that truth is always defined by the situation. What is true? The truth of a situation is always defined by the situation itself. There isn't any abstract quality truth. So you can only refer to this. So I, as much as possible in my translations, when they talk about the two truths, I won't use that term because it encourages that way that this is abstract quality. So the way that I like to handle these two terms, and you may think I'm making mountains out of molehills, but I do that, is I say what is true rather than the truth. With a hope, possibly futile, that this will encourage people to come back to their experience and say, what is true here in what I experience, not out there as some universal abstract that you're aspiring to. Then the second problem is the two terms relative and ultimate. The term that's relative translates is actually the word is completely deceptive is what the literal Tibetan is, kunzo, completely deceptive. So how can you what is completely deceptively true? This doesn't make much sense in English, does it? Well, we need to dig a little bit deeper. Right now, the world appears to us as full of objects of which I am the perceiving subject. Anybody else experience the world that way? Okay, that's how most of us experience the world. I am a perceiving object, the perceiving subject, and all of the and everything is out there as perceived objects. Okay? That is what is completely deceptive. That's not how things actually are. That is how things appear to us. Okay? So this is why I use the term apparently true. And then we and in contrast to that, there is the what would be ultimately true. Now, I don't particularly like the word ultimately. I've been toying with the idea of using something like mystically true. But that raises a whole, yes, exactly, all belly dancers and all kinds of things. again, this is about a $20 word. So if anybody has a word, I'll pay you $20 for this. I have $5 words and $20 words. I have a couple $100 words. So you could earn a lot of money if you're good at this. What it refers to is what is this experience? Now, all of you know that when we examine this experience, if I say, okay, there's a cushion that I see and there's subject-object, but no, I don't actually see a cushion. That's a projection. It's something that arises in my mind as a way of interpreting my experience. But what is my experience? That becomes very, very difficult to say. And that's why we have all of this business about emptiness, because it's referring to, it's impossible to say what this actually is. So that's what ultimately, the word ultimate is referring to. What is experience in itself? And the answer is no thing. It's something that's indescribable. That's why we have it in the Heart Sutra. It is not defined. It is not born or destroyed, pure or impure, not incomplete or complete. There's nothing we can actually say about it. That is what is meant by ultimately true. So with respect to this awakening mind, there is awakening to what is apparently true and awakening to what is ultimately true. And that's what this section is talking about. What does it mean to awaken to what is ultimately, apparently true? It means to recognize that everything that arises, arises in our experience, arises in our mind, and we have to interact with it. We can't ignore it. We can't reject it. There's no point in getting depressed about it. It's up. We have to interact with it. And the only way to interact with it is something that is in our experience, which basically means that we're not going to fight it or be aggressive towards it. We're going to seek to understand it and be present with it. So it moves naturally into the whole ethics of compassion, if you see what I mean. That's awakening to what is apparently true. And it leads to compassion. Awakening to what is ultimately true means, okay, there's this experience. There's even this experience of awakening mind, of wanting to help others and so forth. What is this? Nothing I can say. And rather than try to pin it down and define it, we open to that ineffable, open quality, which is like having no ground whatsoever, and learn how to be in that openness or emptiness. That's awakening to what is ultimately true. Now, how much of this is gobbledygook? Am I making any sense whatsoever? Steve?
Could you just connect what you just said with the video of what happened at the party?
I have to add another wrinkle there. Okay? Three people come to you. And they describe an incident at a party. And you're very disturbed by what they think. It's maybe a friend of yours involved, and you go, it's very strange. So you're concerned. You want to find out what is true. All right? So you're told that there's a video of this incident, and you go and check it out. And now you can you can see what each of those people said corresponding to the video, which one of them is saying what is true, which is the more accurate description. So you think you've got it all sorted out. You still have to deal with your friend. But then you find out that all these three people watched the same video. They thought it was a video of an actual party, and there wasn't anything going on there in the first place. They're reporting their experience of watching a video which they thought was something that was actually happening. It's a bit of a stretch. The point is, what is ultimately true, we can't express in words. We can only experience. You with me there? So, in terms of awakening mind. Who experiences awakening mind? Who gives rise to awakening mind? Steve? Who? There's an owl in here. Who gives rise to awakening mind?
No.
Have you given rise to awakening mind?
I doubt it.
Well, you're here to give rise to awakening mind, and yet you say no one gives rise to awakening mind. That is right. And knowing that, is awakening to what is ultimately true. Sutra, as it says, the bodhisattvas work to help all sentient beings. You read the Diamond Sutra and some of the other sutras, particularly the Perfection of Wisdom sutras, they also say that if a bodhisattva has any conception of a sentient being, he's not a bodhisattva. So, by definition, a bodhisattva can't save any beings. This is talking about what is ultimately true, what it's like. There is just a response without any conceptualization, without drawing any conclusion. And we've all of us experienced that kind of immediate response, which is doesn't involve any intellect. We've experienced that at some point in our lives, usually in some interaction or other. It's just being totally awake and present, knowing what to do, but without any conception of I and other.
In what is absolutely true, I mean, what is relatively true, or whatever.
Well, absolutely and ultimate are used synonymously here. Okay.
Oh, so what is
relative and apparent?
Okay, apparently true. Let's say is the naming of a thing.
Okay.
And ultimately true is the experience. When you are of awakening mind, don't you have both? Aren't they both happening? You don't forget that your name is Ken.
Absolutely, they're both happening. In fact, one experienced them as not being separate. That's one of the big insights of the Mahayana. What is apparently true is not different from what is ultimately true. But it's broken down this way for explanatory purposes.
So in an awakened mind, I can be having the experience. I also am aware that I've named the...
But you don't regard the name as defining the experience. It's just a way of talking about it. And that's what we do. We cling to the reality of words, and that's where the confusion arises. Kara.
I'm sorry. Is that like all ducks are birds, but not all birds are ducks? Like...
No, that's something else.
No, I mean, like, all that is apparently true is ultimately true, but not all that is... Wait. Yeah.
No, it's not like all ducks are birds, but not all birds are ducks. You're trying to include one in the other. It is...
I don't have, like, a good syllogism to sort of...
Yeah.
Question.
I mean, there are various metaphors that are used. They're likened to two wings of a bird. So you need both wisdom and compassion in order to be able to fly.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Randy?
The relative, as a constructivist world, an experience that's from within the subjective I-ness. And the absolute is somehow moving away from that constructiveness I-ness and just leaving the experience sitting there.
I think it's a little different from that. Awakening to what is apparently true is to know the nature of the world that has been constructed and to be able to interact with it skillfully. Awakening to what is apparently true is being able to interact with the world that has been constructed skillfully. It isn't to construct the world. It is being able to relate to the constructed world skillfully.
Just even recognizing that it is a construction.
It's part of it. It's more than that. Yeah. Awakening to what is ultimately true is to know it is a constructed world and to know that all constructions are empty. experientially, not conceptually, which is a little different. Does that help? Okay. Now, since I brought this, I need to use it. So at this point, we have awakening mind, and it's been and two aspects of this being pointed out. So, everybody with me up to this point? Okay. Now, the next distinction that's been made concerns the awakening to what is apparently true. We find this on page 115 in Gunther. And the terms that he uses, aspiration and perseverance. These are early translations. I'm looking, and this is about a $10 word. I'm looking for a better word for aspiration. And the word I use for perseverance is engagement. And what follows is a discussion of two different interpretations of this distinction. The one I favor is the one... And the one that's most commonly used is the one from Shantideva. I'd like to go to a concert. That's aspiration. Going out, buying the tickets, getting in my car, going to the concert itself, that's engagement. And if you look at, again, activities we all that we do, we always have these two aspects. There is wanting to do something and then going about doing it. And that's the distinction that's being made here. It is one thing to want to wake up in order to help all beings. It's a very different thing where we actually go about the work of waking up, and, you know, dismantling reactive patterns, developing the stability of attention, so forth and so forth. And the second grows out of the first. But it needs to grow out of the first. It is not enough simply to want to do something. You actually have to start doing it at some point. I'm part of a coaching organization, they asked me to lead a mentoring group on meditation. So I'm meeting with about a dozen people every once a month. About meditation, and we had our first meeting last Wednesday, and I just said to everybody flatly, there's almost no point in your being in this group unless you meditate half an hour every day for the next 4 months, because we're going to have four meetings. And they all sort of went, what? Like, we have to do something? For some reason in our culture, we often think that learning about something is the same as learning to do something. They really, really aren't. In Greek, in the ancient Greeks, to know something meant that you were actually able to do it. But because of the way that learning has developed, I can understand how a violin makes music. But that, from the Greek point of view, that's not real knowledge, because I can't play a violin. At least none of you here would want me to. I mean, Jack Benny looks really good compared to me. But the... And so it is one thing to aspire to these things, but to make it actually happen and to make it really part of our experience, let me do it. Now, part of the reason that I wanted to put this up so it's clear, these apply to what is apparently true, that is, how we relate to the world. This is how we relate to the world we experience. This is knowing what our experience actually is. Okay, so the apparently true is skill in relating to our experience. This is knowing what our experience actually is, so we aren't confused by it. And of course, the two interact very profoundly, because when we know what our experience is and aren't confused by it, that enhances our skill in relating to it. And if we become very skillful in it, we will come to an understanding of what it actually is. Now... Another thing that some of you have heard me talk about is attention. I should have left more space for myself on this. Intention and will. These are three levels that we find. And they're all of a family. Attention, one could say, is the ability to direct energy. When we're practicing meditation, we are cultivating attention. And one of the things that we're doing is not letting energy be consumed by thoughts and emotions, etc. When those thoughts and emotions arise, we just let them come and go. And the energy is transformed into attention. So attention, in one way, you can look at it as the ability to organize or direct energy. Intention, we can regard as the ability to direct attention. So it's at a higher level. And that means that, okay, so I can stay focused on this. What do I want to do with that? Well, maybe I want to build something. Maybe I want to develop a certain quality. That's an intention. Maybe I want to be a certain way in a situation. That's an intention. And so we start being able to direct our attention in that direction. And now things start to happen because we can do that. One area where this becomes very, very important, well, a couple of areas just on a practical level. One is if you have a project at work or in your personal life, something you want to be able to do. Many years ago, for instance, a woman was working with me, and she... leads a very, very busy work life, but she would like to a partner. And I said, well, if you want to have a partner, you're going to have to create time for it. You know, you can't have your work consume all your time, because otherwise it's just not going to happen. Because relationships take time. That's just very simple. And so she gradually started to form the intention to do that, which meant making changes in her life. So that the that possibility could arise. And that was directing her attention so that she could move forward with her intention. Will can be regarded as the ability to direct intention. So it's still a deeper level of focusing or directing energy. When you're able to develop something at the level of will, you no longer encounter any obstacles. Because whatever arises, you're going to make use of to accomplish your intention. Again, in my consulting work, I was working with a group, and I would say, well, why don't you do X? And they would say, well, we can't do that because of A, B, and C. You know, things that operated in that particular context. And I would say, wrong way to interpret that. A, B, and C just describe the landscape in which you are going to be doing X. You've got to take A and B and C into account, but you don't have to regard them as obstacles. They're just factors that you have to take into consideration. Do you see the distinction I'm making? So rather than saying, this person won't allow us to do that, that's presenting it as an obstacle. You say, okay, currently this person is not of that opinion and will stop us, so I have to figure out a way to change that person's mind or make his efforts to stop me ineffectual or whatever. It's just something that you consider. So the reason I'm going into this is that aspiration, as far as I can understand, corresponds to developing the intention to wake up in order to help others. Engagement indicates that it has moved to the level of will. So you're just going to use whatever arises in your life to wake up. That's what awakening mind means at the level of engagement. There are no obstacles. Whatever arises, you get sick, you know, your arm shot off, your world falls apart. You're just going to use those circumstances to wake up. This is what those of you who studied taking and sending and the mind training teachings, this is what it talks about over and over again. Whatever adversity arises, you make use of it to wake up. Linnea.
I feel like you're just describing these capacities, I guess, with specific scenarios, but also in a general way. And I can't tell if you're saying that a person cultivates intention and then that sort of matures into intention and then into will, regardless of how it's being applied.
It can do that, but one has to be prepared to operate at those levels. So it's not simply that maturation process has to be accompanied by a cultivation, actually an intentional cultivation. Because when you get to the level of will, nothing's going to stop you. And you move from And by that, I don't mean that you become you're able to bulldoze your way through situations. That's not what I mean at all. It means that whatever arises, you're going to figure out some way to make use of it for your intention. Do you follow?
I do.
Now, I'm talking about these in the context of awakening mind or bodhicitta. But what I want, I'm also trying to show, is that these are not abstract concepts which only apply in this rather restricted realm. These are ways of actually looking at how we interact with life. So, I mean, for instance, you've made some changes in your life, and I'm sure you can recognize these because some of those changes you've been working on have not exactly been easy, and you've had to make adjustments. But that's operating at the level of will, because, you know, when this obstacle arose, you went, oh, well, okay, I can work it this way. And you just kept going. So I imagine you can connect with some of this.
Yes, I think I'm still wondering if there's this, I guess I don't need to know the answer to this, but if there's a tipping point where there's a certain point where there's will that is engagement by but choice, and then there's will, which is engagement because you no longer have any way of relating to. Do you see what I mean?
Yes.
Okay.
You have no other way of relating to it. Yeah. I think we'll find that that's covered. They're very thorough, these guys. They were just so thorough. If you skip over to page 116, at the top of page 117 in Gunther, you'll see the formation of an enlightened attitude, that's awakening mind, and as hinted at by others, is said to be frail or firm. When it's just an idea in our heads, that's it's like at the level of aspiration, and it's an idea, that's when it's said to be frail. When it actually takes root in us, and now it's how we relate to the world, that's when it's said to be firm. And I think that's what you're talking about. Say, okay, this is where I'm going. I'll give you an example from my own experience. For a long time, I aspired, to use our vocabulary here, to write a book. And then the aspiration grew stronger, and it became an intention. But intention isn't enough to write a book. At least, not for me anyway, maybe some people can. Because when I actually started to write it, I ran into all kinds of difficulties, you know, one thing after another. Gradually, I learned how to use those difficulties. So now the book just kept being written. And when I encountered a new problem, I recognized it as part of the process. I didn't regard it as an obstacle anymore. And sometimes it held me up for quite a while, but I recognized increasingly this was a part of the process. So this movement from intention to will also is an increasing depth or breadth, either one, of perspective. So you begin to see things differently, but and you can describe intention as will moving up to that larger perspective. That help? Okay, Steve.
The word will, to me, implies some choice. But sometimes engagement happens, you're thrown into engagement.
Yes?
So I'm wondering how that plays into this progression.
You're thrown into engagement. Can you give me an example?
I think I want to maybe buy a new car. Then my car is smashed by someone, and I can't get to work now without buying a new car. That's a poor example.
No, I think it's a very good example. Oh, you could stop going to work. Pardon?
Take a bus.
Yeah. And there's all kinds of other possibilities. You could stop going to work, you could take a bus, you could ride a bicycle, you could carpool, all kinds of things.
So there's still choice, is what you're saying. Even if circumstance
right.
propel you yeah. into engagement.
But you raise a very important point, because people, quite frequently, when people find themselves developing an intention for something that other parts of them are not comfortable with, then they want, there's a tendency to present themselves as being a victim of circumstance. And it's really an abdication of personal responsibility. No. There's always a choice. The only difference is the price one has to pay to exercise it. And it's very, very helpful to remember that. When people say, I can't do this, they aren't actually saying what they can or can't do. They're really saying, I'm not willing to pay the price for doing this. And that's very different. And sometimes the price may be one's life. But that's how it is. Okay? That may be a really hard-assed attitude, but that's how I look at it. Well, we didn't get very far today. Has this discussion been helpful? Okay. Randy, and then I want to move into our meditation.
Seems like there's something missing in the sequence. Okay, the attention is the ability to organize or direct the energy, so I can pull it together. I can stick it into a battery and have it do something. And then I can stick the battery into a flashlight and point it somewhere, and that's the intention of aiming the attention.
Okay.
And then the will, though, is doing something with it, taking the action, moving toward.
Exploring a cave.
But what's in between is the goal. I mean, where does the clarity of where you're going to aim in, of defining the goal towards which you're going to direct your will.
Okay.
That's what seems to be missing to me.
Yes.
In the middle there.
I think that's a very good point. And you remind me again, just by asking that question, how self-referential the whole Tibetan tradition is. Because that question doesn't even arise. The goal, which is full awakening, is just assumed. And so everything is interpreted in that context. And that's why you feel there's a step missing, because that's never named as the goal is just assumed. Do you follow?
But there's different ways of action to get there. How does one choose and clarify and say, okay, this is my path?
Well, then you get into another thing. As you can see, Gampopa is laying out a path, and there's a tendency to say this is the path. Again, it's just assumed. Now, this is describing what I've described here in terms of attention, intention, and will. Could be applied in any context, and the context in which you are applying it will determine what the goal is, and that's going to be up to you. So this isn't talking about how to define objectives or how to define direction. This is saying how you move in a direction. How you define the direction, that's a whole nother matter. Yeah. Okay, good point. Last comment, Kara.
I just wanted to say for those of you playing at home that I'm going to take a picture of the chart and put it on Facebook.
Okay, thank you. Okay, I thought we would get a little further tonight, but I'd rather have these quite detailed discussions as long as you're finding them helpful. Okay. Terms of meditation. I think we'll make this somewhat practical, and you can tell me your experience. It goes something like this. Pick something about your life that needs to change and that you yourself would like to change. And you don't have to make it particularly lofty. It could be improving your golf swing, as someone has asked me about not too long ago. It could be developing a stable meditation practice. It could be making a career change. There could be completing a home repair or something. So, as I say, it can be practical. It doesn't have to be particularly lofty. It can be in the spiritual domain, work, family, career, whatever you want. And so just think of that aspect of your life that you want to change and bring attention to it. And you'll experience certain reactions arising. There'll be probably what arises immediately are some stories, but I'd like you just to let go of those stories and experience what reactions arise in your body when you think of this thing and think of bringing attention to it. What reactions arise in your body? What are the physical sensations associated with that? Then what are the emotional sensations? Whereas in the body there might be a butterflies in the stomach or a tightening in the throat, With emotional sensations, there might be anger, there might be frustration, there might be eagerness, excitement. And when you can stay in the physical sensations and the emotional sensations, then you can include the cognitive sensations. Those are the stories. So you just sit in that experience for a few moments. Not that you regard the stories as real, just they're stories. Now let that go. And consider this change you want to make in your life. And this time, bring intention to it. That is, I'm going to do this. And again, what physical sensations arise when you say, I'm going to do this? What emotional sensations arise? And what stories start to fly around. And again, just sit in that whole experience. And then let that go. And then come back a third time to this change that you want to make in your life. And this time, approach it from the level of will. I'm going to find a way to do this no matter what. And again, what does that feel like physically? what do you experience emotionally? What happens with the stories? Okay. This give you something to work with? Susan? Okay. Is this clear? Any questions? This is somewhat demanding. It sounds very simple, but it can take you fairly deeply into certain areas of your life. So we've gone through it very quickly. I just wanted to give you the basic sequence. You may find when you start, it could start at a level of attention, but particularly when you start moving to the levels of intention or will, deeper emotional material may arise. And so don't try to push through that material, just rest in the experience of it, however much of it you can experience. So this isn't about breaking through anything. This is about getting, seeing what's operating in you. And from there, one can figure out right ways to approach these things. I generally find that the operative word in breakthrough is break. It's not through. And so that's not something I encourage. We bring attention to the stuff that operates in us, and if we can bring a sufficient level of attention, then it will open and resolve itself. And that's a much sounder, more reliable way of working, because then things actually change in us rather than the temporary shifts that we can if we just push. I think that's everything for tonight. I will see you next week. Linnea, can you close, please?
You have just heard a talk by Ken MacLeod, author of Wake Up to Your Life and director of Unfettered Mind, a California nonprofit corporation. This podcast and many others can be found on both iTunes and on the Unfettered Mind website at www.unfetteredmind.org. This podcast is free and has been made available through generous donations from our listeners. We would appreciate any assistance you can offer. Your tax-deductible donations may be made through the Unfettered Mind website, unfetteredmind.org, where you will find translations, articles, information about Buddhism, and other programs given by Ken MacLeod. All rights in this podcast, given by Ken MacLeod, are owned by Unfettered Mind. Unfettered Mind hereby grants you, the listener, the non-exclusive license to listen to and distribute this podcast freely, but only without charge and only if each copy contains all the original contents and these proprietary notices. You may not charge any fee of any kind for making a copy of this podcast available in any form. You may not extract portions of this podcast except for commentary purposes and only if you give proper attribution and this proprietary notice. You may not include this podcast, or any portion thereof, with any other podcasts, talks, information, or data for which any amount is charged. Title, ownership rights, and intellectual property rights in and to this podcast shall remain in Unfettered Mind. This podcast and all elements within it are protected by the copyright laws of the United States and international copyright treaties.